The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Thank you for listening to Overleveraged, where we explore the big macro themes affecting investors, economic imbalances, giant geopolitical trends, tail risks and tremors, and everywhere risks are not being fully priced into markets. Remember, trading carries risk, and all opinions are provided as general market commentary only. Please do your own research. Our risk warning will follow at the end. Welcome to Overleveraged, the podcast about all things markets and macro. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, so do follow us, subscribe and so on. Today, we're going to be talking about AI, which is a big topic, obviously. And joining me is John Heumann, who is the head of content at Vox Markets and former editor of the Investors Chronicle. So thank you for joining us, John.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. Well, I think we've done a couple of podcasts in the past.
We have, yeah.
For Vox and so on. So this is new territory, though, on AI. It's not something that I've... I think we've all kind of come to it. It's all been a new thing, right?
I mean, it's new for a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah. Last sort of year has seen a mega, mega trend. Mm. So I wanted to talk about AI, apart from just sort of... you know, election interference. So we've seen a lot about Taylor Swift. So she's holding up these signs. And I think our image for this podcast, Taylor Swift holding up a Trump 1 sign. And that election interference idea and the sort of deep fakes and so on is obviously a big topic. I don't know if you're a Swiftie, if you've followed.
No, but I have children who grew up in the Taylor Swift era. Yeah. And I have listened to a lot of Taylor Swift albums.
Yeah, I think we all have. My 8-year-old's a massive Swiftie. She's got Swiftie hoodie and everything.
It never got that bad.
Yeah. I think it's peak Swiftie moments now. Obviously the Super Bowl, the election interference stuff, you know, all this sort of stuff is just kind of highlighting some of the issues around AI. And I think it's got people... maybe more concerned, it's got regulators concerned. But I think I wanted to talk about more of the economics and the kind of, because this is supposed to be a macro markets investing type podcast. So, and the economics of it, where we're going to head. So, productivity gains, that's probably the first thing that everyone's talking about. So, the sort of bullish case, that's the sort of upside from AI is this emergence of productivity growth that's going to transform the world, right?
Well, we need it in the UK, at least, or so we're told. But that is, there are potentially huge benefits to AI. I mean, you know, in the same way there have been huge benefits to other iterations of technology before it. So, you know, putting concerns aside, this can do fantastic things, this technology. And it's only getting better. You know, we've seen in recent results season that some of the improvements behind the scenes, some of the plans that big tech has to incorporate AI into their products, and you know productivity assistance, AI assistance in you know sort of office tools, you know, it really really does, you know, present a sea change potentially in the way we work.
Yeah,
and that, you know, in many senses would be a good thing. You know, productivity is what drives economic growth. It's what makes us richer, and it also gives us more free time as well.
Well, free time is, yeah. I mean, that's one way of measuring output, I guess, is not just GDP and not just the dollar output, but the amount of time people have. Yeah. That's another way of looking at it. But this, I mean, obviously with this, it's automation. It's more automation. And I've got some charts, which you can't see because this is a podcast, but... this is from the Economic Policy Institute, and it's in the US. So bear in mind that a lot of the data we'll talk about will be US related, just because
it's
where you can get it,
where it's happening,
and where the data actually exists, because it's not quite, the ONS is not quite up to scratch at the minute, as we know. Any market watcher will know that the ONS is a bit behind the curve at the moment. But this is Economic Policy Institute. So in 1948 to 1973. Productivity goes up 97%, just about. And hourly compensation is up 91%. So workers' wages basically rise with productivity. Since 73 to 2013, productivity is up 75%, so the continued productivity growth, but hourly compensation is up just 9%. So you've seen this huge divergence between capital and labour post-1973. We can probably... discuss why that might be.
Might be a podcast for another time.
Might be to do with Nixon. I don't know. Nixon might come into that. I don't know. Obviously the Nixon shock might have a factor in that, but automation is clearly key. The NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research, they say that 50 to 70% of this is, over the last four decades, is down to automation. And there's other factors, maybe workers' collective bargaining rights and so on. Globalization's played into interconnections with lower wage economies has obviously been a factor. But automation has been key.
I think it's definitely been a part of it. My view on that would actually be that globalization has played the major part in this.
Ah, so that's interesting, because that's a big theme of our series, is this deglobalization that's taking place.
Yeah, and you know, globalization has undermined the bargaining rights of workers in many senses. You know, deindustrialization, shipping jobs overseas in favor of cheaper producers has sort of held back wages in the economies where those jobs have disappeared from. I think it's those two factors that play the majority part. But automation has obviously played a part, because you look at sort of factories, and how they operate, and Japan is probably the most interesting example of the use of automation in factories. They've led the sort of robotic revolution in factories, and it's what keeps their economy alive, essentially. The two things definitely go hand in hand. But I do think it's globalization that has held back wage growth in favor of capital.
Yeah, and that has. Balance interplay between labor and capital is a key theme. We've seen maybe a bit of a shift back towards labor, but it doesn't seem to have lasted very long. It won't last very long. The big question, I guess, with AI, is it like the 1950s to 1970s, where the union of auto workers is getting wage growth for their, they're producing more cars, they're producing more demand for cars, and they're getting more pay? Or is it like the 1800s in Britain, where you get 40 years of massive productivity growth and no real wage growth? So there's a question over what the future looks like, and we don't really know the answer.
Yeah, no, it's a big question. I was reading something the other day. A guy called Ben Rogoff is an investment trust manager who runs a Polar Capital Technology Trust. And what he says is the AI opportunity appears vast, and I think that's true. But we just don't know which new markets are going to be created by it. So it's very hard to see right now what the future looks like with AI disrupting it in a massive, massive way. But, I think what you can be rest assured that it is going to disrupt it in a massive way.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you look at that period of sort of productivity growth before the 70s, you would have huge rooms of clerks and typists and that sort of thing, to actually manage the information behind companies. And obviously computerization changed that completely. So what happened was, it wasn't so much that jobs disappeared, it's just the nature of the workforce changed. So people would have, the skills required would change. People would find themselves moved into different types of role.
Yeah.
So we don't have huge typing pools today, but we have huge IT help desks instead.
Well, that's it. And I got there's a couple of things. McKinsey, they did some research, and they found that 3.5 million jobs destroyed by the PC, by the personal computer, but they reckon almost 16 million jobs created by the personal computer. So, and there's unimaginable new industries. For example, I'm borrowing again from McKinsey here, because it's interesting. It's a great example of the ski industry, how the demand, the Model T Ford, you drive demand for cars. That drives demand for leisure, and people can get out from the cities to the ski resorts. So you get this whole massive industry, particularly in the US, but also in Europe, of the ski industry appearing in the 1950s and 60s, because suddenly everyone's got a car and they can drive to the ski resort, which previously they hadn't been able to do. So no one would have foreseen that industry before. The scale of that industry before you had the product or the technology that created the demand.
Well, it seems like a strange sort of tangential consequence of technology. But I think that's the way these things work. That's exactly the way these things work. So, I was lucky enough to study for a master's in history of science, technology and medicine a few years ago.
Check you out.
and one of the things I looked at was history of computing and particularly semiconductors, and particularly computing in the UK. But in 1978, there was a documentary, I think it was Horizon, called Now the Chips Are Down. I've got a quote from it. It said, microchips will totally revolutionise our way of life. They're a reason why Japan is abandoning its shipbuilding and why our children will grow up without jobs to go to.
Right.
So that's
what sounds like today. That sounds
how it feels like AI is being spoken of today.
Yeah.
But obviously that didn't happen. You know, what instead happened was vast new consumer-focused industries were created.
New demand. Yeah.
New demand was created for new things. Shipbuilding was abandoned in sort of Western economies.
Yeah.
Has shifted elsewhere, but you know, I mean, Korea was an example of a big shipbuilding country that's now going high tech. So, you know, there is a path that these industries take.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think microchips, which were, you know, it was feared would destroy, you know, jobs, lead to mass unemployment. What it did, in fact, was create, you know, the ability to create products like the iPhone or, you know, computer gaming or the internet. You know,
so we shouldn't fear AI, because if history's anything to go by, then it's not going to destroy jobs.
In fact, not in an economic sense.
No,
I'm fearful of it.
Well, and I think the UN was out with a report last year. It's more an agent of change. It's more disruptive. I think Goldman Sachs saying 300 million jobs worldwide being disrupted but not being lost. The UN report does point out that it will affect clerical administrative jobs more. So women in wealthier countries are going to be the ones who maybe suffer the greatest change. There could be some wider impact on that, I don't know. But on the whole, we think it's change rather than destruction.
Yeah, I heard about some, I can't remember who said it. It was something I heard recently, but they said something like white collar is the new blue collar. In the sense that, you know, in the same way that blue collar jobs were most impacted by globalisation, as industries were moved, production was moved into other countries. So white collar jobs are the ones that are potentially most at risk now, as we see this sort of change in the way the service economy is powered. Because AI is part of the service economy, really.
Yeah.
It is also part of the manufacturing economy, because that's the sort of robotic side of things.
Yeah.
But white collar service industries, you know, are going to change.
Yeah.
They're going to change. Now, is that a question of they're going to, you know, the jobs are going to disappear entirely, or the same workers will be able to do more with the time that they have, and therefore create more growth? Because, for example, if you're buying a house, how long does that conveyancing process take? It's an interminable nightmare. If you were to actually use, you know, AI powered technology behind it, you can increase the number of housing transactions that take place.
Everything
a lot smoother.
I met someone who set up a company that did just that. They basically used AI to transform the convincing process from multiple lawyers and weeks to, you know, a few hours, I think.
It shouldn't take as long as it does. and, you know, the sort of standardised technology that we have, where we've got to with sort of, you know, productivity tools that exist pre-AI, they haven't taken it as far as it could go. So, as I say, does AI, it potentially gives the opportunity to increase the throughput of certain service industries. And that's kind of a good thing.
But again, going back to this idea of labour versus capital, what will matter is who. So we know, we assume that the robots are going to be doing a lot of the work, but who owns the robots? Is it the worker? Does labour own the means of production, or does capital own the means of production?
Yes,
and that's going to have huge implications for public policy. Or will it, if the jobs are just changing slightly, if we're basically doing the same sort of jobs?
I mean, that's what we take into an entirely different discussion, which is about the nature of corporate ownership.
Yeah.
and who owns companies? And, you know, there's sort of, I would say, some innovative companies out there that are changing to much more employee-led structures. B Corp, for example. A good example of the B Corp. Corps, they call them, a good example of these. So, where the workforce shares in their gains because they share in the ownership of the companies that they work for.
Yeah.
But I think we are seeing early steps towards that. But, you know, that's the kind of equitable economy that we should have. And one that, you know, where if you put this AI overlay on an economy, on an industry, then, you know, if the ownership structure is correct, then everyone will benefit.
Yeah.
And it, discussion.
Yeah, perhaps that is maybe a different.
But related.
In the meantime, though, there's obviously a big Magnificent Seven sort of thing going on in the market. So just to bring it back slightly to the here and now with investing in markets, you know, we've got Nvidia earnings. I think they're due up on the 21st or 22nd of Feb. So they'll be coming up quite soon. We've had some really strong earnings, obviously lots of chat about AI from these companies. Are they overhyped, or do you think, is the hype justified in all these cases or in some of them, or should we be looking beyond some of the big guys?
I think, I mean, I read a stat. Google mentioned AI 60 times in their latest earnings call, and that didn't include mentions of Gemini, which is their new product, and generative, I think, was the other phrase. So, you know, just all over the reporting season, AI. You know, and big tech numbers, they're strong, and they're staying strong. And, you know, AI has the potential to maintain their strength and justify the ratings that they trade on. So, you know, through various pensions that I have, I own a big chunk of big tech, so I hope so. And that, you know, it's another way I can benefit by investing in those companies.
Yeah.
As a worker. But I do think we need to look beyond that, you know, and I think, you know, AI has the potential put to use, to using the tools that perhaps big tech create to transform other industries. So big tech, for example, healthcare.
Yeah,
is a big.
I knew you were going to talk about healthcare. It's a John Heumann favorite. I mean.
But healthcare is an industry that, you know, could be transformed. By AI.
Yeah.
And there are lots of companies who are working at it at a smaller scale, very specific, you know, medical issues that AI can help with. I look at a company called Intelligent Ultrasound that basically provides AI analysis of fetal scans for maternity. I think GE Healthcare is a partner.
Pregnant people.
I'm trying to think of the sciencey word, but I can't. Obstetrics, is that?
I don't say pregnant women anymore. Pregnant people.
So, you know, that's AI. They develop themselves with a very specific purpose in mind, and it's, you know, it's fantastic. But it's presented as an aid to the clinician. Doesn't replace a clinician, it helps a clinician make better decisions, and it accelerates the process of delivering that aspect of healthcare. You've got companies that are using AI to analyse vast amounts of data to essentially guess, predict the outcomes of clinical studies, how drugs will work. Yeah. And, you know, the amount of data that is produced in these exercises is huge. And AI is potentially the only way to understand it. And you get, you know, quicker delivery of drugs to market and you know, with more efficacy, fewer failures.
Yeah.
So, you know, this industry has potential to be transformed. You know, even something like the NHS, you know, you think of, you know, the productivity gains that could be had.
The lower cost. Imagine an NHS where it costs a tenth because of all, or a half, 50% of what it costs today.
Is it just the cost, or is it about the outcomes? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't necessarily, I'm sure there'll be concerns.
Yeah, I mean, on a like for like.
And actually, cost and outcomes are not unrelated in the way that they're examined. But you know, if your clinicians could see, you know, twice as many patients, you're going to save more lives. And you're going to do it at lower cost. And this is only a good thing. So I think, yeah, obviously the excitement is focused around big tech, but there are many, many companies that could do incredible things with AI for the benefit of humanity and share.
Well, that's that would be good. And then we can all be working 15 hours a week, like John Gaines said we would.
Oh, good. Excellent. Bring it on. You know, but that's you know, that goes back to that point about Henry Ford that you made and the creation of the leisure industry. You know, why should we work all the time? Should we work all the time? You know, if machines can do the work, then that's great. As long as there is a way for people to, you know, exist, to pay for their house, their food, you know, their heating. Then leisure time is no bad thing. And then potentially, you know, if AI comes in and creates or replaces certain tasks, then people have more time to spend on leisure. So invest in leisure. That's not a recommendation.
As long as we can get this, that we can fix this divergence between productivity and compensation, because that's ultimately the key.
That's why I think it's related. You know, those two things are related. And again, it's probably a proper discussion for another time about how we make corporate ownership fairer.
Great. Well, we've covered a fair bit in that time. So thank you, John. John Heumann from Vox Markets. Thanks for your time. And stay tuned on Overleverage, more episodes. We've got more coming. And follow us, like us, and tell all your friends about us. Thanks for listening. Remember, all opinions, news, research, analysis, prices, or other information is provided as general market commentary, not as investment advice, and all potential results discussed are not guaranteed to be achieved. The information may have been derived from publicly available sources, company reports, personal research, or surveys. Past performance is not indicative of future performance. Trading carries risk of capital loss, and the service is available to professional clients only.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.